Affairs. Call to order. Chief of Staff Nick Wojcicki, will you please do a roll call? Or Winter.
Oh, my mic's not. Oh, there it is. Vice Chair Arascada.
There.
Vice Chair Del Carlo. Here. Regent Cruz Crawford.
Here.
Regent Goodman.
Here.
Regent McMichael.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you, Winter. We are going to go ahead and stand and acknowledge the flag for the Pledge of Allegiance. Regent McMichael, will you lead us? Thank you all for making the journey to the beautiful Truckee Meadows Community College. Truly hope all of you had the enjoyment of watching the balloons as they rise over the valley. So once again, thank you all. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, the Washoe, the Numu, Northern Paiute, the Nui, Western Shoshone, and the Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada. So, public comment. I'm going to move to agenda number one on public comment. For those who would like to call in or offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting identification 928-4944-5069 and passcode 555555. Yes. One more time. Please dial 669-444-9171, meeting ID 928-4944-5069 with passcode 555555. We'll take comment from the meeting sites first. And Elko, do we have any public comment from Elko?
No public comment in Elko at this time.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment in Las Vegas? We do. Please continue.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Dr. Sondra Cosgrove. It's spelled S-O-N-D-R-A-C-O-S-G-R-O-V-E. I'm speaking today on agenda item number 4, which is approval of Assembly Bill 37. I'm a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada, and I'm the vice chair of the Nevada Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Our committee's last two reports and our current study all share one important finding. Nevada is in a mental health crisis because we lack behavioral health providers. So this new program, which is under AB 37, is sorely needed. I'm asking you today to please approve it so that we can get to work on filling this very important workforce need. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here on Truckee Meadows Community College? There is not. SCS, is there any public comment in the queue?
There's no public comment at this time.
Fantastic. The second public comment will happen at the end of this meeting with the same process in which we just conducted. We're going to move over to agenda item number 2, minutes for possible action. Are there any corrections, comments from the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, do I have a motion on the table for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Regent Cruz Crawford. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Aye. All opposed, say nay. Motion carries unanimously. We're going to move on to agenda item number 3, the UNLV Organizational Unit Proposal for Institute for Financial Literacy and Wellness. And coming up to the mic is Provost Evie. Dr. Evie, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Escada. Thank you, Chair Escada, Vice Chair Del Carlo, Regents, and Chancellor Charlton. We're delighted to ask for your approval today for the Institute for Financial Literacy and Wellness. President Whitfield is student success president, as he often professes, and he is concerned with wellness completely for the student and the community. And one of the things he charged our leadership team with is harnessing and supercharging the resources that exist on the campus and in the community to build financial literacy and wellness. And so I want to thank our Senior Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, Kate Corgan, and our Associate Vice President for Enrollment Management, Barb Roberts, for taking on this charge and bringing together all of those resources to create this new institute that will support financial literacy and wellness on the campus through academic programming, co-curricular activities, and even community outreach that will offer free financial literacy educational opportunities to the community. And even as part of this, we're looking at trying to create a student-run credit union, which we're in the middle of that process. And so we think this will be a great addition to the services that we offer the student and the community to support financial literacy and wellness, which I think everyone recognizes is a key set of skills for overall success of the student in the university environment and beyond. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the dais? Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Oh, good morning. I don't have a question. I read through the material, and coming from a president that's a psychologist, I thought this was really a wonderful initiative for you to do, and how much it involves the community too. Because as our public comment speaker stated, we do have a mental health crisis in our state, and the more we can wrap our arms around it and address it, the better. And I do remember sitting on this board when I first started that the students at UNLV were willing to pay $5 of credit more to enhance and expand your mental health services. So I see this as a really wonderful, positive thing for our students, faculty, staff, and our citizens. So thank you for this endeavor.
Go ahead, Cruz Crawford.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. I just have a comment. Before I looked through the materials, I was like, I hope they partner with Junior Achievement. And so I do see that we utilize that in the K-5 space for our students for financial literacy. So how wonderful will it be for the kids to get that K-higher ed experience with financial literacy and all of the partners that you use. We use Nevada State Treasurer for our early kickstart, I think, early kindergarten savings. And I just think that all of your partnerships are very helpful to bring in to the whole community. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'll note that President Whitfield has been a big supporter of Junior Achievement since he got on campus and has really leaned into growing that collaboration.
Any other questions, comments from the dais? I just have one, and I'm going to echo the sentiments of Vice Chair Del Carlo, is the dual usage in the community and with the university. Strong compliments to that, President Whitfield. It have that equality and the unilaterally and the opportunity for mental health services throughout the entire South, essentially. And will this also be an online option? for those having any sort of mental health crisis?
I think we will be able to probably add some potential for online offerings because now we're post-pandemic. I think we have a lot of facilities that can support that kind of hybrid type activity.
And for the record, Keith Whitfield, president of UNLV, just to add to that, I think the provost is spot on. We've been talking to a couple of different telehealth providers, and the Clark County School System's been using one, and we're trying to figure out where exactly this is going to fit with everything. But we do have some mental health training that's done by Annie Wiseman, and that is a similar effort to what you're talking about, both to do the telemedicine, but also kind of train the trainers and to be able to spread so that you have peer-to-peer opportunities for wellness as well.
Wonderful. Thank you for the response. This is possible action. Hearing no other questions, seeing no other questions, is there a motion on the table for approval?
So.
First by Vice Chair Del Carlo. Is there a second?
Second.
Oh, I apologize. Regent Perkins.
Oh, no, I was prior to this motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was last minute. It just came to mind because we do so much work with Extension in the South, I was wondering if there might be a partnership available or a partnership opportunity to collaborate with Extension to get it out into the community. Thank you.
For the record, Keith Whitfield, president of UNLV. The provost might have something to add to this, but actually following the lead of President Sandoval, who has been making a really concerted effort to make sure that UNR and UNLV are actually connected through cooperative extension, given that he's sitting right next to me, I guess I'll be in his ear asking about that. So thank you very much for the suggestion.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. And I apologize, my peripheral is not that good, so thank you for pointing out. There was a first by Regent Del Carlo, and Regent McMichael, was you the second? Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Hearing none, seeing none. May I have a roll call? Not a roll call, geez. Still too early, the coffee hasn't kicked in. May please, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Provost. Get comfortable up there. Item number four, we're going to go. Item number four is the UNLV Organizational Unit for Behavioral Health Education, Retention, and Expansion. Provost Heavey, please continue.
Thank you. This, as people have recognized this morning, we do have a mental health workforce crisis in the state of Nevada. And Dr. Sarah Hunt of the Kirkorian School of Medicine has been aware of this and working on this for many years. And we were very pleased to see her get traction this past legislative session with Assembly Bill 34, which has provided actually $2 million of funding to start this new network that will support the entire state in developing a more robust mental health workforce. And it will involve really a K through 20 and beyond set of collaborations across the state. And so this will work on a spoken hub model where this new center or network, as they're calling it, will be housed in the Kirkorian School of Medicine, but will work closely with the statewide programs office of the University of Nevada, Reno, and all of the campuses to support mental health workforce development, and will also work with the K through 12 system in order to raise people's awareness of the opportunities in that, and then we'll work in the postgraduate space to try to create more training opportunities for people after they get their degrees, because often students, after they've graduated, still need to be able to accumulate licensed hours under supervision to earn their license. So kudos to Dr. Sarah Hunt for driving this initiative forward, and I know we're excited to help lead this initiative in collaboration with all of the other institutions across the state. And happy to answer any questions, and I know Dr. Hunt is at the office, at the NC office in Southern Nevada, and is available to answer any questions as well.
Any questions by committee members? Any questions from other regents in attendance?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Regent Boylan.
Thanks, Chair. And this is letting board members know what's happening. Now, this article, this agenda item, like another one coming up, I do believe, and it's not for vanity I say this, but I do believe this should have been mentioned to the Health Sciences Committee Chair, and it should have been more something that we could have discussed in the Health Sciences Committee coming up this afternoon. But since it was, I'll talk more about that at my committee, but there is another item also coming up in it, the item that should have been in the Health Sciences Committee. Health Science is not just Kirkcaldy Medical School or the one up in Reno. There is a ton of other subjects and others in health science. So I would appreciate it next time that this is brought to the Health Sciences Committee and the chair of that committee. Thank you, sir.
Interim, I know.
Please, Interim Chancellor.
Sure. So thank you, Regent Boylan, for that comment. And so I know that in our policies and procedures, we do bring forward, as well as the handbook, new unit proposals for action before ARSA. But perhaps Provost TV and Dr. Hunt would be amenable to, at the next meeting, providing an overview. This is an exciting opportunity and a very high need within Nevada. And so perhaps a presentation before the Health Sciences Committee. So this is to create the unit, which is required, and it's very timely because we also have, they have an appropriation that they need to draw down that has to be part of it expended by June 30th of 2024, and then the second part in June 30th of 2025. So don't know if Provost TV wanted to add to that.
Yes, I know. You're exactly right. I know Dr. Hunt would be eager to present to the Health Sciences Committee on this initiative. And as I mentioned, she's been working on it for many years and actually has updated the board a number of times along the way about this effort, including most recently in February of this past year when there was discussion of AB 34 as a possible avenue for funding this initiative. But I know she will be very eager to share the work that they're doing with the Health Sciences Committee. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Dr. Hunt.
Good morning. Sarah Hunt, for the record, Assistant Dean of Behavioral Health Sciences at the Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine at UNLV. Yes, I'm happy to come talk to any committee that would love to learn more about the Be Here Network.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please, Regent Boylan, go ahead.
Thank you. And thanks to Ms. Charlton and I nearly said Ms. Evie. Provost Stevie and Dr. I appreciate that. Just making it clear that we have to do things in such a way that we are all aware of what's happening. So it would be amendable to anything going on in the university, in the entry system, that the committees are responsible for them. I'm made aware of what's happening. That's all I'm trying to get at. But I do appreciate anything that you might bring to us. And I'll ask you next time. Thank you so much.
I can't either.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. One of the items I've
sir.
One of the items I was noticing with Assembly Bill 37, with the passing of that, is and the Be Here, it's a center that's being established and to serve the entire state of Nevada. Regardless if you're Clark County, Wash County, you're looking at the rules, you're looking everywhere. And that's going to be a great benefit to the entire state of Nevada. And the populations in which it's going to be targeted to are primarily for the mental health. Doesn't matter age, race, political reference, irrelevant. What it is mostly for the mental health mental health and what's best for the state of Nevada, and I commend you all. Thank you very much. So, hearing the comments from Regent Provost Heavey, do we have any other questions, comments on the dais? Excellent. Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Regent Cruz Crawford. Did I hear that? Thank you. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. Provost Seavey, again, item number 5, which is the organizational unit proposal for Tourist Safety Institute. What I'd like to hear about. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair Arascata and Regents and Chancellor. This is another instance where there is a great collaboration between the state and the university that recognizes the ability of the state to utilize university expertise on a critical issue for our economy, which is tourist safety. And so Dr. Robert Ulmer, who is the dean of our College of Urban Affairs, has a long history of collaborating with state entities to help them think through various issues related to promoting tourist safety. And so at the last minute in the legislative session, there was an opportunity to secure ongoing funding to increase the ability of his faculty and staff to lean into this issue so that they could work with our industry and our law enforcement and state leaders to help develop policy and actionable recommendations to promote tourist safety. So the legislature did allocate $1 million in funding to support this new initiative, and Dean Ulmer has been already actively at work to bring together the campus resources and grow the partnerships that will make this institute successful. And we're asking for approval today to create the formal organizational unit that will be the administrative home of this activity. And Dean Ulmer is present in Southern Nevada, and both he and I are happy to answer any questions you might have about this new institute.
Any questions from committee members? Any questions from additional regents in attendance?
Oh, and I'm sorry, if I could add one comment, there is a correction that we need to make to the proposal that we submitted. We recognized in our last minute review of this that we had added into the budget costs for indirect expenses. And because this is a state line item in the budget, we realize we cannot do that. And so we will amend the budget so that all of the funds that were allocated by the legislature will be either used for the direct activities of the center, or if any of those funds are unused, they'll be returned to the state per policy.
And with that, I believe you're referring to page 5 of the presented material. So on page 5 of the proposal for the presented material, for the 2-year duration, the total expenditure is approximately $720,000.
Yes.
Following this, the allocation of 28%, also known as, well, $280,000, has been placed for facilities and administration.
Right.
To me, the 28%, that seems high.
Right, so that will go to 0%. You're correct. That will drop to zero. So all of those funds will be available either for the direct activities of the center, or they'll get returned to the state. So that was a mistake on our part to include that, and we apologize for that.
Okay. So with the $280,000, is that going to be infused into the Greenspan College of Urban Affairs?
Yes, so they will adjust the budget to use that for the direct activities of the center by employing, you know, faculty and staff for that work, or one of the things that Chancellor Charlton noted in her comments is that the time frame for expending these funds is limited, and so it's kind of a race against the clock to get these activities stood up. And so it's possible that they won't expend all of the funds, and then if they revert to the state per state policy.
Awesome. Interim Chancellor Charlton?
No, just wanted to echo Provost TV's comments that this does have a sunset provision by the end of the biennium, and then any funds not expended would be reverted to the state of Nevada.
Thank you. Any questions from the dais? Region Cruz Crawford, please.
I think this is great. This Region Cruz Crawford, for the record, we are having a stadium built. We have Raider Stadium. Vegas is changing. I know this is for the state of Nevada, but people are going to keep coming to Vegas if they know it's a safe place. And I see that you are getting funds or trying to secure funds from our hotels. So hopefully our resort fees will pay for some of this. Because sometimes I don't know what they pay for. So, but no, I do think it's a great, great investment in our future because people come to Vegas because it's safe and it's clean. And we have so many beautiful places outside of Las Vegas that are natural, beautiful places to see, like Tahoe. So I'm excited to see how this investment works out for us.
Thank you.
Well stated. Do we have any other questions, comments? Seeing and hearing no other comments, do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Is there a second? Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Nay. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Provost TV, one more time. Let's go with item number six, please. UNLV program proposal for a BA in creative practice for possible action. Please, creative practice, expand on that one.
Thank you, Chair Arascata, Regents, and Chancellor. We are asking for approval today for a new degree program, as you noted, that is designed really with two purposes in mind. One is for people who are specializing in the fine arts, but really want to have a role beyond just performance, such as museum curator or in the business of fine arts, where the experience in a particular fine art discipline will be important, but a broader set of skills will be necessary. We also have students who start in a performance track sometimes, but either because of their own interests or their lack of passing the juries that are necessary to complete in a performance track, need a degree completion path. And so this degree will both serve both purposes simultaneously, to have this kind of broader work in the creative and arts, or to students who want to finish a fine arts degree but don't want to continue on the performance path. And we have Associate Dean Dr. Tim Jones down in Southern Nevada, who's been a critical part of developing this proposal, available with me if you have any questions about this new degree program.
Any question from the committee? Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Again, I don't have any questions. I thought the briefing paper was very well written and very self-explanatory. But again, I applaud UNLV for doing this program. I never realized there was so much to fine arts and the different venues you could go to. And I saw how collaborative this was. I think there was a piece from the business school being so supportive. And I really like that you looked at other universities with their similar programs that you put in the briefing paper. I thought that was really great because, I mean, we are the entertainment capital of the world. Mm-hmm. I say we. I'm not from Vegas. I'm from up here. But we are all proud Nevadans in this room. And this is one of the things that we can do better than anybody in the world. Our hospitality college, now this fine arts program. And I'm so delighted that there's the money that was funded in the last legislature to get a new building for you, desperately needed. So this program is going to be wonderful for those students that aren't going to play or sing or whatever, but they're going to be more in the administrative part. And I just look to our own head of our Nevada Museum here in Nevada, here in Reno, who's just so brilliant in his job. And I thought of him when I read this, because he runs our museum here so beautifully, and they're expanding, and I see nothing but just really great things ahead for the school and this program. And this may even attract even more students, because I think that creative side of a person is so very important to develop. And we don't think we're creative. We're told we're not, but we all are. We all have creative genes in us. And it's a wonderful that you're bringing all that out together with the business to have a good career and job. So thank you for this.
Thank you.
Thank you for your words. Well put. Provost Hebe, question for you. If you could provide clarity on the methodology with the first, third, and fifth year projected headcount. That was the question, because in the current methodology listed on page 15, it's about as clear as mud. So if you can help me on that, I'd appreciate it.
I might have to phone a friend for that one, but get to that page in the proposal. I know that currently we have a large number of students majoring in fine arts. We have over 2,600 students in this college currently, and so we anticipate that this degree will attract a significant number of students right away. And so I think we thought of these numbers as fairly conservative, and basically that we anticipate the students being enrolled full-time, and thus the full-time equivalent count and the headcount being the same, though we sometimes go back and forth on how we calculate those numbers. It's always a little confusing.
Okay. On new business at the end of today's meeting, I'm gonna be putting in something, not just for yours in particular, just for past items and for future items, and something we'll get follow-up on. But thank you. Yeah, that page 15, it was a little difficult. But we'll definitely follow up in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Provost Hebe, I know you're comfortable up there, so you can stay for more, if you can have a seat. It's up to you.
Thank you.
Very well done. We greatly appreciate your time. We're going to slide over to item number 7, which is UNR organizational. My goodness, I apologize. Once I said that, coffee is still not kicked in. Is there a motion for approval on the dais? Vice Chair DelCarlo, thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Chair McMichael. Any other questions, comments? Seeing none, hearing none. Thank you very much. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. And thank you all for your patience today. Item number 7, Provost Thompson, I see you walking up. The organizational unit proposal for UNR, the Larson Institute for Health Impact and Equity. Provost Thompson, please.
Good morning, Chair Escada, members of the Board of Regents, and Chancellor Charlton. On behalf of the University of Nevada, Reno, Jeff Thompson, Executive Vice President and Provost, we're bringing forward for your consideration a proposal to create the Larson Institute for Health Impact and Equity in the School of Public Health. The Institute is being named in honor of Dr. Trudy Larson, who served as the founding dean of the School of Public Health until retirement in 2021. Under Dr. Larson's tenure, a group began to secure significant funding and grow in major grants and staff size that was working on health impacts and equities in our state. And the mission of the Larson Institute will be to foster community-engaged research, health equity programming, training, capacity building, and workforce development initiatives that measure impact and elevate the health status of diverse populations. The Larson Institute is a research and public engagement initiative with sponsored activities focusing on conducting data analysis and research and providing research support to community members, faculty, and students. The Institute will not have a teaching mission, but it will support internships and hands-on opportunities for students in a variety of disciplines. They'll conduct community-based research, develop projects that engage diverse populations, and will connect subject matter experts with key populations to improve health equity in Nevada and beyond. The Larson Institute will be self-supporting, with no state funds or financial support requested from the university. It is anticipated that the Institute will continue to generate income from grants and contract works to support itself. I appreciate your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, comments? How about any questions, comments from regents in attendance? Vice Chair Del Carlo.
Thank you. The research here then adds to the research of an R1 mission, correct?
Absolutely.
So that's wonderful. I like that. And I would say, too, that I think Dr. Trudy Larson epitomizes what this is going to be. She, as the founding dean of the school, I couldn't think of a better person to name it after. So, I mean, what a wonderful legacy for her. And I don't know if she's watching today, but kudos to you, Trudy. I'm really happy for it.
Thank you.
And also, this is a great way to expand the community in public health, not just research, but especially with diverse populations. And the Larson Institute will be self-funded, as you mentioned, at approximately $3 million. Okay. So essentially, it'll bring together and consolidate research into one location. Is that correct?
That is correct, and it will also create interdisciplinary opportunities for faculty and students on campus.
Expand on that, please.
Well, health inequities and impacts go across a lot of different disciplines, from medicine, nursing, public health, social work, psychology. So it will be a way to bring all of those faculty in with their expertise, particularly when they have funded projects that need people from across different disciplines to help resolve issues.
Excellent. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are there any more questions, comments from the committee? Regents outside the committee?
Same Chair Arascata, this is...
Please, go ahead.
Apologies. This is Regent Carvalho. I did have a question for Provost Thompson regarding the partnership with the University of Arizona, if he could expand on that.
So that one, I apologize. I cannot give you details on that, but I can come back to you. I will get back to you. We typically have partnerships with a lot of different universities for different reasons, but the particular one, University of Arizona, I cannot comment on at the moment.
That's fine. Thank you.
There'll be follow-up.
I will follow up.
Thank you for your forthright answer. Once again, seeing none here, no other comment, do I have a motion for approval? First by Vice Chair Del Carlo. Is there a second?
Second.
Regent McMichael, really appreciate it. No other questions, comments? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Nay.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Thank you. Item number 8, the handbook revision for fee waivers for Native Americans. Acting Vice Chancellor of Academic and Student Affairs, who is also now... And a new title for our interim chancellor, Patty Charlton, will present for approval for the revision of the handbook. Okay. Please.
Thank you, Chair Arascata and Regents. I'd actually like to ask Associate Vice Chancellor Renee Davis for Academic and Student Affairs to present both the next two items related to the handbook. She is our expert and guru in all things related to fee waivers and many, many things. Renee?
Good morning, Renee Davis, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. We bring for you today for your consideration a revision to Title IV, Chapter 17, Section 16, Fee Waivers for Native Americans. And we're essentially doing two things with this revision. One is we're correcting something that was missing from the original proposal that we brought forward in June. We had, in the original proposal, made a reference to our existing board policy having to do with members of tribes located partially or wholly in the state of Nevada. And that didn't quite cover the whole entire population that was covered in the bill. So this simply would bring the handbook language up to date and in compliance with the bill. And essentially, it doesn't matter if the member of the tribe actually lives on those lands. It's just that their membership is the part that's important, or descendancy, based on the bill. And then the second item that we're doing is we're adding a little clarification, because this latest revision to the fee waiver includes non-credit courses and self-supported courses. These are courses where students don't always earn a GPA for the courses they take, and so we wanted to add some clarity that the 2.0 GPA requirement applies only when a GPA actually exists. So those are the two things that we really needed to handle with this revision. We also made a few minor grammatical corrections that we found after the fact. So I'm ready to answer any questions, but if not, would ask for your approval, please.
Are there any questions from committee members? Any questions from regents in attendance? So, Ms. Davis, question for you. So what you're saying, and I just want to clarify, so the student receiving fee waiver must be a member of the federally recognized tribe with lands either wholly or partially located in the state of Nevada?
That is one category of eligibility, Regent Arascata, and that's the one that we're trying to fix. But there also are other provisions for the potential fee waiver recipient could be a member of any tribe, federally recognized, but has perhaps established residency in the state. So that would be, if you're looking at the policy, Section 16.1(b)(i), that one is, that addresses that population. But yes, the one that we're trying to fix is exactly what you said.
Okay. So that student is not required to live on those lands to qualify for the waiver?
Correct.
Okay. Was there a financial impact stated?
It's no different from the last financial. So it doesn't really change from that original fiscal note. So this particular change, we didn't put a fiscal note on because there was not a change from the original policy. It's just really a technical correction.
Thank you. Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question. I know this was given to us by the legislature. I'm totally supportive. I think it's a wonderful thing. I find it difficult to have an unfunded mandate that is just going to continue to grow. So with the change that the last legislature did, so you can be part of any nationally recognized federal tribe, and if you move to Nevada and establish residency, then you are eligible, correct?
Renee Davis, for the record, that is correct.
Okay, so is there other states that have this, or is Nevada like the only state that's giving this free tuition to Native Americans? Do you know?
Renee Davis, for the record, I'm not positive, but it's my understanding that this is more generous than what is in existence in other states.
Okay. So I think it's going to be our job in the next legislature to present a well-documented case on the cost, because, I mean, I think it's a wonderful program. Don't get me wrong. They deserve it, but there's a cost to it, too, that our institutions always, with the 12% we just experienced, the 11% looming, and the fiscal cliff that we're going to be hearing on Friday, I think we have got to be realistic that, you know, there's no free lunch in life, so we've got to make sure that this, the state understands this mandate is costly for us and can help. Thank you.
Vice Chair, excuse me. Interim Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair Escada, through you to Regent Del Carlo. The other benefit that we have that the legislature did put into place is that we will do an interim study on all of the fee waivers, and so that will help us a great deal to exactly advance what you just stated, Regent Del Carlo. So I know that Renee and her team are very anxious to get that going. We're just waiting for the interim committee to be established because this is an important factor for our institutions, just as you said, from a fiscal impact statement. Perspective.
Any other comments from committee members? Comments from other regents on the dais?
Mayor.
Yes, Regent Goodman. Regent Goodman, you've just muted out on us. I think your mute's on.
I just wanted to express my support of what Regent Del Carlo just said. It's very important that we maintain fiscal responsibility moving forward.
Well stated. Seeing and hearing no other comment, do I have a motion on the table for approval? Motion first by Regent Del Carlo, seconded by Regent McMichael.
Second.
Thank you, sir. No other questions, comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Let's continue to item number 9. Ms. Davis, you mentioned that you're going to be also talking about an additional handbook revision for the fee waivers for recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Please.
Thank you, Renee Davis, for the record. So this next proposal to Title IV, Chapter 7, Section 15, Fee Waivers for Recipients of Congressional Medal of Honor, comes forward at the request of Regent McMichael. You all will recall that we previously brought a proposal to you that was approved to establish this fee waiver. And since that time, we had modeled it on the Purple Heart fee waiver established by the state. And that changed during this last session. So we're looking to update it at the Regent's request to include a child of such a member who received the Congressional Medal of Honor. And one thing of note, we made it fairly straightforward that it's just simply the child of the member, and then we put the usual age limits, which is 10 years after the student turns 18. That's very standard with other fee waivers that are similar. But one thing we didn't do that the state law does for the Purple Heart fee waiver is it gets a little complicated with the child has to be a graduate of a Nevada high school, and the Purple Heart fee waiver recipient has to be a resident of the state of Nevada. And so we didn't put that in this because we figured this is already such a narrow pool, we didn't want to make it, so it just wasn't ever going to happen. So we thought this was a good middle road. So with that, I would entertain any questions you might have and would please request your approval.
Questions on from the committee? Questions from additional regents? Oh, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair. Have we identified any eligible people, or are we going to wait to see who comes forward? And how is that being communicated to these people if they are in Nevada? I mean, through veterans groups or what? Thank you.
Renee Davis, for the record. So when these types of fee waivers or other programs are passed in policy, then it really is often the campuses that do the outreach. And so in the case of this very particular and specific bill, I know that we have some great advocates on our campuses for veterans populations, so I'm sure that they're going to do a great job getting the word out about that. But to my knowledge, I don't know that we go out and try to seek out individuals. Also, we know that the Congressional Medal of Honor, Chancellor Charlton has done quite a bit of research on the Congressional Medal of Honor recipients, and we know that there aren't a great number of them currently alive. Many of them actually were awarded based on Civil War service, for example. So I don't know if Chancellor Charlton has any nuggets she wants to share. No. So, but it is a fairly small population.
No, I would say it is limited, but the majority of the surviving Congressional Medal of Honor recipients are actually from the Vietnam War. That's the largest group that's left, and so, which is sad, but over 3,000 plus Congressional Medal of Honor recipients, over 1,500 were from the Civil War alone. And so it's a very narrow but very prestigious award. And I would just echo what Renee had stated, that our veterans offices on our campus are absolutely unbelievable. And so communicating with them and their outreach, I think, will go a long way.
Thank you all. So just for clarification, this is correcting and streamlining the wording and the appropriate verbiage. Is that correct?
This is adding new language to add the
it's
child
new language.
Of.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you very much for the clarification. Do we have any other questions, comments from the committee members? Oh, I apologize. Regent Boylan, please continue.
Thank you, sir. No problem. Regent Del Carlo, can kind of covered my question. Do we have even recipients in our entry schools, colleges, etc.? That's what I'm curious about, which would be awesome. So I suppose either Ms. Charlton or Ms. Davis would know that.
Regent Boylan, this is Renee Davis for the record.
Yes, ma'am.
You broke up a little bit, but I think maybe your question was, do we have any recipients currently of this award in our institutions? And no, we haven't had any yet. It is pretty new.
Yes, ma'am, that was my question.
Okay.
Thank you. That was my question, so I appreciate that. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Hearing no other comments, do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Second. Regent Carvalho. First, Del Carlo. Jeez, I was looking at Regent Carvalho down there on the video. Second, thank you very much. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much, Ms. Davis. Regent McMichael, thank you, sir. We're going to go over to item number 10, the Foster Youth Fee Waiver and Program Report. This is going to be presented by the Foster Youth Ambassador, Laura Obrist, and will present a report regarding the Foster Youth Waiver adopted by the board in 2018. Ms. Obrist, please.
Yes, my biggest worry is the clicker, so hopefully I get this right. Laura Obrist, for the record, I am the system level representative for the NSHE Fostering Success Initiative, and thank you to the Regents for the opportunity to present today. All right, there we go. I will be covering two topic areas today, which are outlined in much greater detail in the report. First, I'll be talking about the progress of the fee waiver program over the past 5 years. And second, I'm going to share some major highlights of the system-wide initiative work over the past 2 years since the last biennial report. And the first thing we're going to cover is the growth of the fee waiver program. So the initiative was launched when the board unanimously approved the Foster Youth Fee Waiver in September of 2018. So we are now at the 5-year mark for this crucial piece of financial aid for our students who have experienced foster care. Nevada was the 29th state to implement a college financial assistance program specifically for students with foster care history. And as of 2022, there are now an estimated 37 statewide college financial assistance programs that are dedicated to college students with foster care history. In approving the waiver, the board laid the foundation for our higher education system to more effectively support these students. And following the board's lead, a committed statewide network of NSHE employees and community partners is working collaboratively to achieve the initiative's ultimate vision of building a comprehensive, sustainable, and permanent education support system for Nevada students who've experienced foster care from secondary education completion to post-secondary education attainment to a career path. And with this vision in mind, the initiative's mission is to more effectively recruit, support, and retain students who have experienced foster care. And the fee waiver is key in achieving that goal. So the policy has evolved since the board approved the original version. At the June 2022 meeting, the board made two fee waiver policy changes that slightly expanded eligibility. First, the board standardized the eligibility requirements for young people who were in the care of a Nevada child welfare agency, regardless of the state from which they graduated high school. And second, they reduced the age at which a student must have been in the custody of the Nevada foster care system from 14 to 13 years old, because age 13 perfectly aligns with the FAFSA question related to this population. So since the fee waiver policy was approved, NSHE employees and community partners who are part of what is now known as the Nevada Fostering Higher Education Support Network have been working diligently to raise awareness of the fee waiver program throughout the state. The first entering cohort for the waiver was in the 2018 to 19 year, and we had 38 students. We're now up to 116 unduplicated students as of the latest year we have data for, which means that the number of students awarded waivers across the system grew by 205.3% between the first and fourth years. In terms of cost, the total cost of the waiver across the system started at $106,361 in year one and increased to $426,478 by year four. This is an increase of 301% between year one and year four. The remaining data that we will be covering, sorry, I didn't switch, the remaining data on the recipients includes demographics, persistence, and graduation rates, and then the credentials earned. So this data was a new addition for the second biennial report. And first, I'm going to go over the demographic info for the most recent year. In terms of race ethnicity, the distribution of funds based on student race and ethnicity indicates that the percentage of historically minoritized students who received the fee waiver during year four was higher than the overall historically minoritized student population at UNLV, UNR, Nevada State, and WNC. As far as our current gender data, the percentage of female students who received the fee waiver during the last academic year we have data for was higher than the overall female student population across all institutions, whereas the percentage of male students who received the fee waiver during the same year was lower than the overall male student population across all institutions. The last type of demographic data that we analyzed for this waiver was income level. Since it's a need-based financial aid program and recipients are required to file a FAFSA, income information is available for all recipients. This is perhaps the most compelling piece of demographic information for this fee waiver. Data collected from the campuses for required reporting demonstrates that, as intended, the program is reaching students with high financial need. As you can see, the median annual income of our recipients for this year was just $4,511. We also examined fall-to-fall persistence rates for recipients, looking at students who received the waiver in a fall semester and enrolled the following fall or earned a degree at any INSHE institution. The data illustrates that there was a general upward trend at the system level in the persistence rates across the 4 years in which the fee waiver has been available thus far. For the most recent year of data, which represents 21 to 22, there was a 69% persistence rate recorded across the system. And this table focuses on the graduation data. Because 18-19 was the first academic year of the program, and the latest available graduate data is as of June 2022, few recipients have yet to graduate with a degree or certificate. The table reflects the percentage of recipients in each of the four academic years tracked who graduated with a skills certificate, associate degree, or bachelor's degree by June 2022. It's important to note that not enough time has elapsed since the program's inception to report the percentage of fee waiver recipients who graduate in common time increments, such as 150% of degree time frame. This final data table examines the number and types of credentials earned by fee waiver recipients thus far. In the first 4 years that the waiver was offered, we saw one completed skills certificate, 11 completed associate degrees, and 14 completed bachelor's degrees. It's important to note that if a student earned more than one credential at an INSHE institution, only the highest credential earned is reflected in the table. And I do know that we have those students. Next, I'm going to talk a little bit about the collaborative statewide initiative work. So as a result of the fee waiver approval and establishment of the initiative, INSHE was approached by the Walter S. Johnson Foundation and invited to apply for an initial one-year $200,000 grant, which was approved. We were then able to apply for and secure two subsequent grants from the foundation for a total of $1.2 million in private grant funding over 6 years to assist with creating my role in launching the system-wide initiative work. We were also able to add a system-level student worker position beginning with the second year of funding. My role is dedicated to achieving the mission in collaboration with the statewide network, coordinated group of our student leaders that have foster care history, our institution employees, and other key stakeholders. My role is tasked with leading the network, particularly the core members who make up our Nevada Fostering Higher Education Committee, in the development and implementation of effective post-secondary education planning, preparation, access, transition, and persistence practices. These practices are formulated to assist young people who have experienced trauma, educational instability, inadequate financial resources, and limited support systems. And our two main priorities are increasing financial aid access and utilization, as well as improving and expanding post-secondary education-specific wraparound support for Nevada students who've been in care. The foundation has also directly awarded grants totaling $955,000 to three of our institutions, and those are as follows. So TMCC has been awarded a total of $255,000 in seed funding to build stronger housing stability and peer mentor support for their students who have experienced foster care and to help launch their TMCC Fostering College Success Program. UNLV has been awarded a total of $500,000 to help launch their UNLV Fostering Scholars Program and assist the program with its early growth efforts. And UNR has been awarded $200,000 to help launch UNR Fostering the PAC. Between the system and institution level grants, we've received a total of $2,155,000 in seed funding from the foundation to help us launch a stronger support system for our students who've been in care. And now I'm going to share some of the major highlights over the past 2 years since the first report was presented in September 21. And there are four key areas our work falls into. So the first one is student voice and leadership. I'm not going to go through all of these. The first area is focused on student voice and leadership in the sense of this being particularly important for this population because they have spent their lives in situations and systems that have given them very little autonomy and a limited voice in decision-making that directly impacts them, often long-term. Therefore, we know that student support programming only works if it is student-led and or informed. As a result, a student-led and or informed approach is woven through all of our initiative work, meaning that student input and participation is always welcome and highly encouraged. We have formal student leadership roles as well as opportunities for other students throughout the system to serve on the statewide committee, participate in the annual retreats, and or participate in other specialized projects. We also lead with student input when we develop and revise the initiative's goals. A notable example of the initiative's student voice and leadership focus is the September 2022 name change from Foster Youth Success Initiative to Fostering Success Initiative. This change removed the label of foster youth and reflects a person-centered, age-inclusive approach to supporting students who've been in care. The system-wide peer and community educator role itself is another notable example. In the 20 to 21 year, we utilized some of the grant funding to establish that role. It's a part-time position that works closely with me in the chancellor's office, providing outreach and training across the state. The role is designed to give a new student the opportunity each year. Our third entry student to hold the role, UNLV student Tony Duncan, is currently helping me onboard her successor, Thea Ewers, who is a UNR student. The initiative was also able to add a second student leadership role this year through the iFoster Jobs Program. Our office established an MOU with iFoster to serve as a host site for the program's inaugural year for one part-time AmeriCorps member who's an entry student or recent grad. And this role is known as our student voice and resource navigator. UNLV graduate Adam Matthews was the first student placed in that role for a 10-month term that goes through January 2024, and we plan to continue serving as a host site along with UNLV, which currently has two members, and hoping CSN and Nevada State will join us. The second focus area is about building and maintaining a cohesive statewide network that collaborates and is committed to learning about the unique circumstances, challenges, and needs of this population. Our third and fourth retreats are a major example in this area. During the retreats, members of the statewide committee work collaboratively to build a more cohesive statewide learning community that's focused on this population in terms of accessing and thriving in college. We learn from student leaders with lived expertise in foster care and the professionals who serve them, and we discuss and co-develop collective priorities for the next year. Another example here is the NC Fostering Success Champions Quarterly Roundtables, which I started this year in February. They provide a new quarterly professional development group space for the campus-based staff and faculty at our institutions, who I refer to as our champions. Our third focus area is a system-level outreach and development, the development and provision of resources. First, knowing that our students who've been in care, the people who support them, the institutions, and our community partners need reliable information about the post-secondary education processes, resources, and support that's specific to this population. The Department of Academic and Student Affairs has worked to create, improve, and expand electronic reference materials and an online and social media presence that will better serve the educational best interests of students with foster care history. For example, in May of this year, the department launched its first issue of a system-wide initiative newsletter in honor of National Foster Care Month to improve and expand upon existing efforts to ensure that our students, employees, and community partners are well-informed about key resources and developments. If you want to get the newsletter, you can sign up on our website. Another key example in this area is the UNLV Fostering Scholars Program Coordinator Heather Richardson. Peer and community educator Tony Duncan and I all serve on a monthly 8th Judicial Court, District Court, OPLA Review Panel. It's a long name. They started in early 2022, and that is designed to improve the high school to college pipeline for Clark County youth in foster care. And finally, throughout 22 and 23, the NC Department of Academic and Student Affairs partnered with Foster Love again. We've partnered with them before to provide supplemental funding support to Nevada students who've been in care through their Rapid Response Program. The program reserved $15,000 for each of those calendar years for students that are transitioning or already in college. And then this year, they gave us an additional $10,000 in textbook supports, which is funded through the Walter S. Johnson Foundation. Those funds are flexible and available to cover expenses that cannot be covered by financial aid or other resources. And our final focus area is institution-level capacity building. And there's been a lot of development since the last fee waiver report presentation. While all of our schools are working to build stronger support for students with foster care history, our most notable growth in this area has been at our three schools that have established campus-based support programs that are dedicated to this population. So UNLV launched the first full-time position in campus-based support program known as Fostering Scholars in fall 21, combining internal funds with private grant funding from the Walter S. Johnson Foundation. The program serves students who were in foster care at age 13 or older, regardless of fee waiver eligibility. And UNLV is also leading the way with both internal and external funding sustainability efforts for this work. This is thanks to the dedication of Program Coordinator Heather Richardson, who successfully secured a second seed funding grant from the foundation and internal UNLV CSUN funding, as well as cultivating a partnership with private donors Linda and Blake Maxwell that has greatly assisted with program growth, and that includes GA and MSW practicum student staffing. UNR launched the second campus-based program known as Fostering the Pack the next semester in spring 22. It serves fee waiver eligible students that are enrolled as well as supporting prospective students with their transition. The program currently uses a graduate assistant staffing model with seed funding from the foundation and some internal funding. The MSW student currently directly serving those students is Jamie Picasso Farias, and Dr. James Beatty oversees the program. They also have a student in the program serve as a peer mentor. And finally, TMCC officially launched their Fostering College Success Program in spring of 2023 after part-time college success advocate, Fostering College Success Advocate Annalisa Walker was hired in August 22. That program serves current and prospective TMCC students who've been in care, regardless of fee waiver eligibility, and Yvonne Allen oversees the project. And that is all the updates I have for you. Do you have any questions?
Are there any questions or comments from committee members? Outside committee members? Regent Perkins.
I just
grabbed little Regent Perkins first.
Yeah, you're
there. Please, Regent Cruz Crawford.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. I saw your outreach. What kind of outreach do you have for the high schools?
Outreach in general, or were you talking about a specific...
So that they're aware of the program.
Yes. So that is one of the biggest things that we're constantly working on because, as I'm sure you can imagine, you can never do enough outreach. Mm-hmm. So we hit that from a lot of different angles. So we work very closely with the statewide network that I mentioned, and then more closely the committee. We have about 30 organizations, including our 7 schools, and obviously system office representation. And so the child welfare providers, the attorneys that work with young people, the independent living workers, all kinds of folks are trying to give them that information repeatedly. I do outreach and presentations, as well as our campus folks. We've worked to get more of an online footprint and put things out that way, and also to collaborate with, you know, folks like the school counselors and the liaisons that are assigned to that population. We're also working on some data projects with NDE and collaborating with DCFS as well, the state child welfare agency, to try to improve some of our outreach efforts to get to students earlier before they're coming to us, so that they're getting the information about what they're eligible for and what they should do to prepare for whatever college option they're hoping to go for, so that it's not last minute to where maybe they don't have the right classes or other things that they might need.
Because Infinite Campus, which most of our schools, districts use, our foster youth are flagged. And our clerks are automatically Title I HOPE liaisons for the school. So it seems like it would hit a lot of kids if you hopped on to that, like a foster liaison, like Title I HOPE.
Yes, we work closely with those folks.
Because they're trained, and then as soon as those kids are flagged, we do outreach to them already. So it would complement, and I think it would be great outreach so that they know prior to graduation.
Yes, I agree. And, we are utilizing that and also looking for ways to kind of fill some of the gaps, because there's, you know, every data system has its limitations, and then staffing it can be tricky. And so I think that's one of our biggest challenges, is that things don't always go as we would hope. And so, we're always trying to talk to our partners about where those gaps are and where we can help fill them.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you. Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Thank you and your crew for all your hard work. We can see by the numbers that this started off as basically a dream, and now you had over a 200% increase, which is absolutely incredible. So you have been reaching students, and just wanted to say kudos. And it's a very worthwhile program for students that have, like you said, been exposed to things that children never should have to be exposed to. So thank you and your crew.
Thank you. Yeah, it's definitely a team effort, and thank you to all of you for supporting the work.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair. I just would like to add a little historical context, because I'm the only regent that was there in 2018 when we voted this in, and it came from our former chancellor, Tom Riley, who was a social worker in his career in Clark County. I think he was a county manager also at one time. So he brought this to the board, and I remember saying, this is just the right thing to do, and it's still the right thing to do. It's another one of our unfunded mandates, but this is one that we're just doing the right thing, and as my colleague, Regent Perkins, pointed out, the program is growing, and Regent Cruz Crawford has her fingers in education from K-12, so her suggestions are really great, too. These children need as much help as we can give them, and I do remember Chancellor Riley having a round table, invited some regents up to, it was at team, actually here at Team CC, and to listen to these students, it breaks your heart what these kids go through. And I just can't be more proud of this program. And I know in 2018, we were like the 32nd state to pass this. And I see they're at 37 states. So I'm sure this is all over the country too. But I would say too, when we get to item 11 on our main board agenda down the road, that this kind of funding also be included in our funding study, because this is really important. These are Nevada students, and we know we're 49th in the nation for kids going on to higher education, and this is a wonderful way to help those students and help drive our numbers up too. So we need to incorporate that. But I really appreciate, you've been with the program since day one, I believe.
Since day one of my job, yes. The fee waiver came before me.
Right. And you were hired to do this job, Laura, and I really appreciate your dedication. You can see you have really passion for this, and our students are lucky to have you. We all are. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Very well stated, and thank you for the historical knowledge on that one. Very well. Thank you. This is an information-only item. And Ms. Oberst, thank you very much. Very well done. We're going to move on to item number 11, which is going to be the research analysis. Jose Quiroga, will present highlights from the 21-22 INSHE financial aid report. This is good. Please, Jose.
Thank you, Chair Escada, Vice Chair DeCarlo, and Regents for the opportunity to talk and present the 2021-22 financial aid report. We know financial aid supports all of our students directly in their pursuit of higher education. It supports the board's strategic goals, and the report fulfills board requirements and gives us an opportunity to talk about the national landscape of financial aid and how that landscape affects our students here in Nevada. Acknowledging that we may not have a full 30 minutes to talk about it, I will go through some of these slides quickly, but happy to answer any questions on the presentation or the report. So let's dive right in. As we look at the aggregate amount of student aid disbursed in 21-22, it totaled $656.5 million. That is a large amount and an amount that has increased over the last 5 years plus. Almost every year, 2020-21 being an exception, mainly due to COVID-19 pandemic and issues around that. But over the last year, we see a nearly 1% increase in financial aid disbursed, over 5 years, a 5.5% increase. However, those changes in financial aid disbursed are not across every category or institution, so we'll dive into that deeper in the next few slides. As we look at the breakdown by institution, we see that the largest increases have occurred at our four-year institutions. Our universities, with UNLV, UNR, and Nevada State, all experienced increases over the last year and over the last 5 years. At our two-year institutions, our community colleges, we do see overall a decrease over the last year, and most of them a decrease over the last 5 years. As I talked to my financial or the financial aid directors at all of our institutions, there were several reasons for that. One is the continuing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. The tight labor market more quickly affects our 2 years institutions enrollment during 2021-22, especially that we saw that tight labor market draw students sometimes away from higher education. And not only is there lower enrollment at most institutions, but at several, there is a higher or an increase in dual-enrolled students. Dual-enrolled students are usually not eligible for financial aid, but they are eligible for a registration discount. So they will not be reflected in financial aid numbers. We also see a decrease in loans being taken out by students at many of these institutions, and we'll talk about that more in the following slide. Like my colleague Laura did, we do break this down by demographics. We want to make sure that students are accessing financial aid at similar rates. And especially as we look in the bottom, I'll draw your attention to the bottom two rows here of as we group together historically minoritized recipients. And the last row looks at the student population, the overall student population of historically minoritized students. What we see is at most institutions, the percentage of financial aid recipients that are part of historically minoritized racial and ethnic groups are higher than their overall population, and at all of them, it's at least similar. And that's something that we want to look at, we want to track over the years to make sure that we're continuing along that route where all of our students are having access to our financial aid programs. And that's something that I know all of our institutions and financial aid offices are always out there making sure all of our students are getting information on how to apply for the FAFSA and all other aid. What is new this year, starting in 21-22, is at Regent Arascata's request, we began gathering data on how our students who are registered with the disability resource centers at our institutions accessing financial aid. And this is the first time that we were able to fully gather that data. That I know it took us a few years, Regent Arascata, but I think it was a really important request and one that we are continuing to work on. What we see here is, I think, really good news. We're seeing that students registered with the DRCs are accessing financial aid at least similar, rates, many times at higher rates than students who are not enrolled. Hard to go into exactly why, but you know, these students are often meeting with DRC counselors, and I know that our financial aid offices have a focus on making sure that all students are accessing financial aid. We'll continue to track this number on future reports as well. Next, I'll start looking at specific programs, some of the major programs that our students receive. In 21-22, the Pell Grant, this chart looks at the average Pell Grant received by students. We do see that it remained flat between 2020-21 and 21-22. That isn't a typo, it's an exact dollar amount. I had to check it a couple of times. It's different by a few cents. What we see is that though that remained flat, the overall amount of Pell Grants dispersed did increase, meaning that more students are receiving Pell Grants. A little under 1%, it was 0.9% more students received the Pell Grant in 21-22 compared to prior years. Now, one thing that I do like to point out is that the maximum award could for that year was $6,495 over fall spring. However, we will never reach that. No institution would usually reach that because for a student to receive that maximum amount, they would have to have the highest category of financial need and enroll full-time, 12 credits or more. So we can work on one of those, right? We can work on getting our students to enroll in more credits. We can't really have all of our students be at their maximum financial need. However, it's an area that we track and continue to overall see growth over several years. I will also point out that this is one of the major programs students receive aid in, with $124.2 million being dispersed to our students across institutions. As opposed to the growth we've seen in Pell Grant, as we look at student loans, those have decreased over the years. That is, I think, a good trend that we see that decrease. It matches the national landscape. Students are borrowing less, and our financial aid offices are working with students to make sure that they're well-informed as they borrow. I would be remiss if I didn't point out, as a former financial aid administrator and somebody that used student loans, that student loans can be a really important part and a necessary part in funding a student's education. I would not have been able to go through my education without student loans, and nor would many students that I have counseled. However, seeing that lowering trend is really encouraging. It again tells me of the work that financial aid offices are doing, talking with their students, making sure they're well-informed, they're only borrowing what they need. And that is decreasing. Over the last 5 years, it's decreased approximately 7%. The last kind of major category here of aid that I will go over is Nevada state-funded financial aid programs. And I will, in the interest of time, I will only touch on the ones that had major changes. The overall category of these programs remained relatively flat, a very small increase from the previous year. However, we do see some changes in the two major programs. The Millennium Scholarship decreased for the first time in a long time, both in total dollars awarded and in the percent of the total of these groups. Several reasons for that. Again, the pandemic touched everything, including enrollment, and partially caused by the pandemic, partially not, the number of high school graduates in 2021-22 was lower. If that continues, that could affect many things, but one of them will be Millennium Scholarship Awards. Some of the other programs remained relatively the same, but another change was in the Region's Higher Education Opportunity Award. We counted in state-funded programs, however, it is only about 14% of the program is funded by the state. The majority of that program, 86.2%, is funded by registration fee set-asides. So it's our own students paying into their fees is what is funding most of this program. And it disbursed $71.3 million. That's an increase from the prior year. And it continues to increase as a percentage total of our programs. Okay. I do want to touch on some financial aid terms because these are confusing even for a financial aid administrator or a former financial aid administrator. I have to be careful when I'm using category sources, types, to make sure that I'm talking about the correct terms. So I do want to give a quick refresher as we go into the next ways that we sliced these data. When we talk about categories, there's four major ones: grants, scholarships, loans, and work study. Our grants and scholarship are what we talk about when we're talking about kind of free money awards, awards that the student does not have to repay. The major difference that I want to point out in these two is that grants tend to be based on financial need, and scholarships tend to be based on merit items like writing an essay, maybe test scores or athletic scholarships. There's lots of different categories. There's a little bit of crossover. Some grants require completion of an essay. Some scholarships require financial need. But these are general categories. We all know what loans are, money that has to be repaid. I do like to point out there's been a lot of talk of loan forgiveness, but that is really limited for them. Most students do have to repay the vast majority of loans. And finally, when we talk about work study, we do count work study as a financial aid award, but the student does have to act to work to earn those funds. So as we look at that breakdown, we will see loans remain the highest category of financial aid disbursed, but that has decreased in the last several years, 5 years plus. And scholarships, grants, especially grants, and student employment have picked up that proportion of aid disbursed. When we talk about sources of financial aid, those can come from the federal government, the state government, from the institution itself, and from the private sector. Some of the major awards under federal include the Pell Grant, direct student loans are the biggest program there. State funds we already talked about, the six major programs there. Institutional funds include a piece of the RHEOE award, RHEOA award, and scholarships. And on the private side, we have scholarships, grants, loans, all from the private sector that come to help fund our students. With that, we see the federal government makes up the majority of the sources of financial aid. However, that has also decreased, and that is paired with the decrease in student loans, because most financial aid loans are federal. As those decrease, so do the federal government, as well as Pell Grant. Although it has increased over the years, it has not proportionally kept pace with increases in state and institutional aid. Then we have need and non-need-based awards. I won't belabor this point, but need-based awards require the student to demonstrate financial need. Non-need-based awards don't require that. That doesn't mean that a student receiving that type of aid may have high financial need, but is not required in the awarding of that financial aid. And you'll see that both categories include all types of aid. We just ordered them by which ones give more weight to need versus less weight to need. In this one, we included the last 10 plus years of financial aid, and just to show that shift from almost a 50-50, not quite split into a 2011-12, to increasing non-need aid. Many reasons for that. Over most of those years, the Millennium Scholarship increased by leaps and bounds almost every year, except for last year. Which increased non-need, and as student loans, the highest decrease in student loans has been in the subsidized category. Our highest need students are borrowing less. Again, I think a good thing when that's being replaced by other aid, but it's important as our financial aid advisors talk with our students that students are borrowing when necessary and are not only swayed by national conversation of the student loan crisis, that the real can sometimes serve as an impediment for a student that really needs a small amount to get through their education. The last kind of term, or one of the last terms here I'll speak about, is the cost of attendance. I'll go through this quickly, but the cost of it, because many of you have already know this term well, but this cost of attendance is the overall budget that the school creates for students. It is, has federally regulated elements that acknowledge that tuition, fees, and books are not the only cost of higher education. A student has to pay for their transportation, their meals, their housing, all of that that being in school requires. That serves as both a limit in all of the total financial aid a student can receive and a part of the calculation of financial need, which I'll mention how that works in a future slide here. I will just very quickly go through the next three slides just to mention these are the cost of attendances at our seven campuses, or degree granted campuses. In 2021-22, you'll notice a difference because each school calculates their cost of attendance based on their own student population, usually with surveys, making sure that they're reflecting the actual costs of their students. And this would be for undergraduate full-time students. There are separate cost of attendances for students in different categories. Now, FAFSA, one of our favorite topics, because it is one that all students ask about, and rightly so. The free application for federal student aid, I will point out that it does say free, so a student should never pay to fill out the FAFSA. I just plug that in wherever I can, because I hear of too many students paying sometimes to do it, which they never should. And financial aid advisors are always there and available to help students fill this out. It's an annual application, and it's used to come out with what's called the expected family contribution, and that's a number that's used to calculate a student's financial need. I will also point out here that usually I say this is an annual application coming out October 1st. It will not this year. We've been notified by the Department of Education that because they're doing major changes to the application this year, that will be delayed until December is the expected time frame. Again, an important tool in determining financial need, and we covered some of those major changes that are going to occur in a presentation on June 21 that's linked from this presentation. The way that we use FAFSA to determine need is by using that expected family contribution. So it is cost of attendance minus expected family contribution that gives us financial need. Now, that financial need minus any aid the student receives gives us the amount of remaining student need. If a student has a positive remaining student needs, they could potentially qualify for a need-based aid, for a lot of different types of need-based aid. And I did want to give an example as well of how that works for a student. These are samples of what a student might get as part of their offer letter. Offer letters have a lot more information than this. But this is a conversation that a financial advisor may have with a student. This is what we estimate your cost of attendance is. Placeholder numbers, of course. Your student's particular situation may be different. This is your expected family contribution, not necessarily what you're giving, what you're actually able to contribute toward your education costs, but what comes out of the FAFSA. This is your need, the aid that you're receiving. Let's talk together about your remaining need and how we may cover that. Sometimes that may be loans, sometimes that may be working, or if family's able to contribute. I will point out that we've had a lower need student at UNR and a higher need student at CSN as examples. These are not meant to convey anything about any student population. They were just examples so that you could see how different types of students would receive different types of aid and how that would affect their financial aid package. Finally, I did want to point out that in this year was the largest disbursement of HERF funds, the Higher Education Emergency Relief, which was not included in the other data analysis because it was one-shot monies. This is the last time that there are HERF funds. fingers crossed, as long as there's no need for them in the future. Even when including this large disbursement, there has been that trend of lower financial aid from the federal government compared to other sources still holds true over at least a 5-year period. So I went through that really quickly. I hope that it was still helpful as we talk about the, both our financial aid here and national landscape. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. That was a great presentation. Are there any questions from committee members? Any questions from other regents in attendance? Regent Downs.
So when you, Regent Downs, for the record, thank you, Chair Arascata. So when you talk about the need-based versus not need-based, those numbers, are they based off of the results of the FAFSA?
So as we talk about those need and non-need, most, yes, usually a student receiving need-based aid would, in order to qualify for it, would fill out the FAFSA. It would be that calculation of cost of attendance minus expected family contribution, and a student would be eligible in that calculation. The Pell Grant is slightly different, also counted as need-based, and it is based on the FAFSA numbers as well.
Does FAFSA adjust every year with the inflationary costs?
It does have their own calculation, and it does, the numbers that they use in their calculation is tweaked every year. And there, I will point out that there is a major overhaul to that calculation for the 24-25 school year coming up, in which a lot more students will be eligible for like an automatic lowest, I would say automatic zero, they're going to call it automatic negative 1500. Regardless, it means the highest financial need that there is. And they do adjust every year based on funds available, especially for the Pell Grant. Okay. That number, that EFC, expected family contribution, has increased. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. The highest EFC that's eligible for the Pell Grant, for example, has increased over the years.
Okay.
The other way that that updates is because cost of attendances typically have gone up over the years. So as you have a higher cost of attendance minus EFC, as cost of attendance increases, it means that we're going to see higher financial need.
I didn't know if looking at the chart where the need-based had gone down as time had gone on, you attributed part of that to the millennium, but I didn't know part of that could also be that they haven't been keeping those adjustments to the actual cost of living expenses. So.
And that is very possible. I haven't looked at that specifically. I will point out that I believe the overall dollars over time have increased, but yes, the proportion has decreased of okay. need versus non-need.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Regent Downs. Any other questions, comments? Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair. I would just add context to what Regent Downs was asking, because we're a member of ACCT, the Association of Community College Trustees, and their main focus for their members is advocacy. And they go to the Hill. We go every year in February. Usually there's a pretty good-sized delegation. We had students 2 years ago, and it was very meaningful to take our students. But we go and advocate for increased FAFSA funding, and it should be noted too that last year the Congress passed the prison education. This is first year this year that students in, or well, we call them students, we don't call them prisoners, we call them students when they're incarcerated and that are taking classes. So I think that's really good too, but I just wanted to say that, because we, you know, it's really great that we advocate for our students in Congress. So thank you. And I did have a question. I did the math, and 21.3% of our, that one slide you showed, all the different, you know, with the Kenny Gwynn, the Nevada Promise, there's $139.9 million in state funding out of $656.3 million total student aid that's received. So the state's funding 21.3%. And do you know, Jose, if we're like average in the country, or is that lower, higher than most other states? And If you don't have that, could you get that for me, please?
I can come back with that.
Okay.
I will point out that it is an even lower amount because a good 86% of that RHEOA is actually student funded. So the whole $139.9 million is an even inflated amount of state aid. So I will point that out in the data we get back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Wonderful. Great point there, Regent Del Carlo. Any questions? Oh, Regent Cruz Crawford, please.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. A couple of questions. Who sets the parameters for the Millennium Scholarship? Is that the Treasurer's Office? Or is that like, who sets the parameters?
Jose Quiroga, for the record. The parameters are set both in NRS, mm-hmm. Along with, there are some that are set in the handbook, set by the Board of Regents. However, the basic parameters are set in NRS.
Okay. And then I'm just wondering, because it seems like it changes, you know, all what's evolved, I guess, to make it last longer, I guess. The next question I have is, do we use all the funds that are set aside for the Millennium Scholarship in Nevada Promise?
Definitely. So interestingly, the funding mechanism for the Millennium is kind of separate from I would say this. It so far has not been limited by the funding of the award. So all of our students who are eligible for the Millennium receive it. There have been concerns about that money running out, and there has been over time. General fund infusions of money into the Millennium Fund. But all of our students who are eligible mm-hmm. receive the Millennium.
So my question is, are we using all the funds? I'd like a report if I'll do that under new business. I just want to make sure that we're using the money that we have, you know, set aside for that. And then in your report, I got a text from a constituent asking about private loans that students and parents take out. Are those available, that data available?
That data is included in the loans dollars, but we didn't break it out into private loans.
Okay.
That data does come from our campuses.
Okay. Because I do think that's significant because typically they're higher rates and don't qualify for if there is loan forgiveness later on, a lot of the times, the private loans?
Agreed. Although the vast majority of loans are federal, the students that do have to take out private loans, usually it is at a much higher rate than that is subsidized or even unsubsidized loans from the federal government. So it is an important part to point out that private loans are there and most of the time are not mm-hmm. as advantageous as a federal loan.
And I just want to do a shout out. My daughter's going to UNR. I made her take out the smallest loan ever just to build out some responsibility. We did Nevada prepaid tuition because I was educated on the programs we have in Nevada. But she did have to go through loan counseling. So I really appreciate, I don't know if I got that. That's probably why I just finished paying my student loans last year. You know, I think it's good for kids. It kind of freaked her out, but then I'm like, it's $500. You're fine. But anyways, I think it is good to educate our students, and I appreciate the efforts the universities are doing and colleges. Yeah,
thank you. I'm also paying my student loans back.
And right I have now. A little cold. I'm not crying over this, even though financial aid does make me cry sometimes.
Any other questions, comments? This information you provided was extremely helpful today in our audience. I think we have the largest contingency of students I've seen at most quarterly meetings. And hopefully they all listened with great intent because having the opportunity for this financial aid and the financial aid report provides every student a greater opportunity to achieve graduation with potentially debt-free or minor debt, if that. So we look forward to future reports. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
I have a question.
Oh, hold on one sec, Jose. Regent McMichael, I apologize. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I'm still finding it Hard to believe that most of these private loan companies somehow get first crack at the students. Why is it these companies still even exist if we have federal loans, Millennium Scholarships, Pell Grants available for students? How is it we can't get to them first so that if they have to take out any additional loans, it'd be a much smaller portion of the finance burden that they have?
Happy to answer that, Regent Michaels. I will say these comments will be on my experience as a previous financial aid administrator, not because I've talked to specifically on this point with our directors. Several reasons there why that still exists. What I will say, again, most vast majority of loans are federal loans, some institutional. The private loans are a smaller pool to fewer students. Reasons why a student might need a private loan include a student who has lost eligibility for federal aid. There are requirements to get federal loans, and those can be sometimes looser with private loans. Private loans may not require a 2.0 GPA, a 67% completion rate, some of those type of requirements. Another is a student that is coming back. Let's say, as an example, a student that already received their bachelor's, already received their master's. Now they want to come back and be a nurse, get retrained at one of our community colleges or universities, and maybe tapped out that maximum eligibility of loans. That can be another reason why private loans. I do know that all of our financial aid offices work with our students to make sure that they're at least considering and looking at federal financial aids if they have eligibility before going over to private loans.
Thank you, Regent McMichael.
Thank you, Jose.
Thank you.
This item was for information only, so thank you very much. We are going to move on to item number 12. Any new business from committee members? Regent Cruz Crawford.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. I would like to delve into the Millennium Scholarship piece some more. Troubling that they've gone down so many times, especially that's how I went to college. That's how my daughter's going to college. So, if we could get some information on maybe the shift over time of the requirements, and if those requirements maybe are pushing out some students that would have been previously qualified, and then also what the funding amount pot is and how much of that we're utilizing. I'd like to know those things. Thank you.
Excellent. Great questions. Anyone else? I do have a couple of them. First is a high-level introduction to the data dashboard. It's in order not just to familiarize regents, but participants regarding the availability of the statistics throughout the system. The data dashboard is a hidden gem on the website, and more should know about this. Also, I'd like to get some strong response on follow-ups with the approved programs over the past 12 to 24 months, in which I'll work with staff on this. For examples of previously approved program, during the March 2023 quarterly meeting, UNR received a program of approval for College of Education and Early Childhood with a first semester cohort of 60 students. Also in December of 22, ARSA approved a UNLV proposal of a Master Arts in Teaching Elementary Education with an enrollment of 50 students. And in 2022, GBC requests approval for an Associate of Applied Science with a cohort of just 3 students. But we'd like to get some follow-up. We're approving all these programs and some potential education opportunities with hopefully not grandiose expectations of what the enrollments are going to be. So we need to get a stronger grasp of what the estimated enrollment and what the actual enrollment are going to be. Those would be extremely helpful. Just today, as I was mentioned earlier to Provost Heavey, was a creative practice at UNLV with the start date of 2024. We need to get some more historical perspective on what the actuals are compared to the estimates. So thank you. We're going to move on to item number 13. We're going to go to public comment. Is there any public comment at Great Basin College in Elko? Hearing none, seeing none. Is there any public comment at the Systems Administrative Office at Las Vegas?
There is no public comment in Las Vegas.
Is there any public comment here at TMCC? There is. Please continue.
Kent Irvin, ERVIN, past president, Nevada Faculty Alliance. Good morning, Chair Arscada, Vice Chair DelCarlo, and Regents. First, I would like to thank TMC students who are paying $4 per credit for this nice facility we are using. Second, regarding fee waivers for Native American students, Assembly Bill 150 included a $915,000 appropriation to NSHE to defray the expenses. This was the first time that the legislature funded fee waivers, and we should recognize them and thank sponsor Assemblywoman Natha Anderson. It needs, of course, to become a regular state budget item. Third, I want to draw your attention to an item that was removed from your agenda today, the elimination of minimum degree requirements for instructors of community college courses from the handbook. First of all, thank you for deleting this item from the original consent agenda. The briefing paper for the change in faculty qualifications presented it simply as a cleanup of the handbook, and it misstated its true effect of completely eliminating any minimum credentials for course instructors at the community colleges. This had the appearance of trying to sneak through a substantive change. If there's a desire to have an honest discussion about minimum requirements for faculty members teaching our students, we can have that conversation, which should, of course, include minimum credentials for dual enrollment and concurrent enrollment course instructors. But I have to object to the attempt to put through such a substantive change for faculty and students as a committee consent agenda item. That's not how shared governance works. Thank you.
Thank you. SCS, are there any public comments on the phone queue?
There is no online public comment at this time.
Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. BFF will start in just a few short minutes.